Ich freue mich sehr, Ihnen jetzt gleich Carrie Facer vorstellen zu dürfen. Zuvor vielen, vielen Dank an die neuen Expertinnen und an Jugend Hackt. Morgen werden wir über diese Themen mit Bundespräsident Frank-Walter Steinmeier sprechen. Wir sind eingeladen nach Schloss Bellevue und dieses Gespräch mit Schülerinnen und Schülern wollen wir auch fortsetzen bei Schools of Tomorrow. Wir werden einen Ideenwettbewerb lancieren, der im nächsten Jahr dann zusammengetragen wird. Wir möchten die Diskussion heraushören, was ist Schülerinnen und Schülern wichtig und wie sie sehen, das lohnt sich. Das ist ein ganz toller Auftakt. Carrie Facer ist Professor of Educational and Social Futures at the University of Bristol. Ich mache doch weiter auf Deutsch. Sie arbeitet an einer Neubestimmung der Beziehungen zwischen Bildungseinrichtungen und der Gesellschaft, unter anderem mit dem Connected Communities Programm, das kollaborative Forschungsvorhaben zwischen Universität und gemeinschaftlichen Organisationen durchführt. Ihre Publikation Learning Futures, Education, Technology and Social Change und The Politics of Education and Technology, Conflicts, Controversies, Connections sind, wie ich das zuvor schon gesagt hatte, eine wunderbare Kombination aus Systematik und politischer Imagination. We are training your German by now.
Testing.
I'm getting it. Okay. Yeah. Nach der Keynote haben Sie Gelegenheit zu fragen. Carrie Facer.
Dankeschön. Good evening and thank you so much, Sylvia, and the organizers of this event. For the invitation to be part of such an exciting conference. I've gotten good news for the students. There are schools in the UK where young people start at 11 o'clock in the morning because they've done research and they've discovered that teenagers work better later in the day. You know this already, but there's some research. Also, there's quite a lot of evidence that homework isn't a very good idea. So, you know, there's lots of people out there looking at it. Thank you for allowing me to speak in English and thank you to the translators. It is fantastic to be in Berlin. I haven't been here for many, many years. My first visit was in 1987, when as a schoolgirl I visited the Reichstag with a German friend. I walked up the grand staircase and I looked out through the windows at the back of the building. And from there I could see the control towers, the armed soldiers, the wall, and the no man's land beyond. My third visit, 2 years later, was completely different. I recall walking up to the Brandenburg Gate and hearing this huge, strange noise. I couldn't work out what it was. And as we got closer and closer, I suddenly realized it was the sound of thousands and thousands of people chipping holes in the wall, literally tearing it down with their hands and their hammers. And I found myself that evening, a couple of days before New Year's Eve in 1989, sitting on top of the wall, sharing a cigarette with the border guards. This is familiar history to many of you in this room, but it is important to remember that the world can change massively, quickly, and unexpectedly when we're talking, as we are in this conference, about educational futures. We need to remember that futures can be radically different from what we expect. So the question I want to explore with you this evening really is, what sorts of tomorrows should our schools prepare young people for? But before answering this question, and I'm going to do this a few times this evening, let's warm ourselves up by actually imagining ourselves, by placing ourselves in the future in some way. I want you to close your eyes for a minute. Don't worry, you are among friends, you're safe. I want you to think about the year 2037. How old will you be? And don't worry, you don't have to tell anybody. What will that world be like? What will stay the same? What will change? What are you basing your assumptions on? Okay, you can open your eyes now. What I wanted to do was to position ourselves in the future so that we know it's going to happen. It's not just a rhetorical flourish. So about 10 years ago, I gathered a group of international experts children, young people and educators to look at the sorts of trends that might impact on education to 2035. And I want to start this evening by running through some of these. So the first trend that we're looking at is a trend towards a globally aging society. We're experiencing globally massive demographic shift towards aging populations, the likes of which we have never seen before. By 2035, the likelihood is that 50% of the population of Western Europe will be aged over 50, with a further 40-year life expectancy, and a further 25% aged over 65. We have never lived in a society that is shaped like this, with equal numbers of older adults and children. And on top of this, Ray Kurzweil, the futurologist, says that if we live to 2020, we will be able to surf the waves of medical development, those of us who can afford the medical bills, and live for a few hundred years. What will lifelong learning look like in that context? The second trend that we want to think about is growing economic inequalities. There is a clear trend towards wealth being held by an ever smaller minority. The gap between the richest and poorest is likely to continue to increase, with the rungs on the employment ladder becoming harder and harder to climb. This brings huge implications for social cohesion. At the same time, just as automation and new forms of employment have hit the work of taxi drivers and factory workers, so too will automation, artificial intelligence, and robotics start affecting the previously seemingly secure middle-class jobs, doctors, lawyers, accountants. Who would you rather operated on you, the first-time surgeon or the robot who has 100,000 examples of the same operation to draw upon? Third trend, the social and economic impacts of climate change. Climate change will be, by definition, unpredictable and chaotic. Hands up who thought Berlin would be sunnier at this time of year. I have a new coat now, it's all good. The 2-degree temperature rise that we seem to be moving towards brings about a 45% species loss. It means huge costs to maintain public infrastructure in the face of more extreme weather. It means increasing movements of people from climate-stressed areas in North Africa and the Mediterranean. Fourth trend is technological trends. There are going to be a number of significant trends that we're likely to be living with, assuming our infrastructures survive the previous two issues. These trends include living in massively data-rich environments in which we ourselves become data centres. How many of you are wearing a personal tracking device or a Fitbit? How many have we got in this room? Have we got many? Oh, over there. That's where the techies are. Okay, yeah. You're at the forefront of the trend towards quantifying the self. But more interesting trends as well include the increasing collaboration we'll be having with non-human-like intelligence. We're already, every day, working within and with complex technological systems. We're dancing with them through our cities as we take transport systems, use Google, watch planes fly overhead. We're part of complex technical systems whose working we are completely unaware of. Did you know that over half the traffic on the internet is our devices talking to each other? But our collaborations with non-human intelligence, could you show the image, the film there? See if that works, yeah. So our collaborations with non-human intelligence may become much more explicit, an experience of consciously working alongside new beings. We will get used to millions of tiny robots doing mundane tasks, or perhaps relying on humanoid robots to care for us in old age. And this little video is completely compelling. It's a packing office in China where they're sorting out parcels. And with changing technologies come changing ideas of what it means to be human. We can expect to be carrying massive resources of artificial intelligence in our pockets, supporting everyday tasks from instantaneous translation, apologies translators, to diagnosis of medical problems. And at the same time, genetics and neuroscience will offer us new forms of personalized medicine, new accounts of our capabilities, talents, and dispositions. And on this basis, we can imagine a situation in which educators will be faced with very different sorts of people in their schools. There may be new hippies whose parents resist any form of augmentation. sitting alongside young people who like to augment themselves with physical and digital attachments, sitting alongside those who are going the genetic and biological enhancement route. This will make for interesting classrooms. If this sounds fanciful, just consider the fact that in 2009, a survey in Nature reported that when asked whether healthy children under the age of 16 should be restricted from taking cognition-enhancing drugs, most respondents said they should. But one-third of respondents said that they would feel pressure to give cognition-enhancing drugs to their children if other children were taking them. Our technologies enter our social and cultural contexts. So since my first study 10 years ago, we have, of course, witnessed trends taking new forms and breeding uncertainty. We've witnessed the deepening and ongoing economic crisis, which is a crisis of inequalities and extraction of wealth by minorities. We've seen a resurgence of populist and nationalist sentiment, which puts the European project itself in doubt. And I speak as a British person who is in a state of trauma at the moment. We're seeing the return internationally of great power politics and the spectre of nuclear war. We've seen the first waves of international movements of people as a result of war, economics, and climate stress. But we've also, in that 10 years, seen the growth of social media to create a Twitter sphere we couldn't have imagined. We've seen the development of new energy sources. We've seen the growth of civil society and cities as forces in addressing climate change. We've also, and I came across this last week, we've discovered a worm that can eat plastic and make antifreeze. This is very cool, I think. We've also seen the development of a worldwide love affair with videos of cats and printers. So the point is, the world is a strange, changing, and complex place. These different social, technological, environmental, economic, and political forces will intersect to create the world we'll be living in 20 years. It will not just be technological change that determines our future, but the ways in which we respond to these changes economically, politically, and culturally. And what this means is that the future is both profoundly, creatively, and excitingly unknowable, and it is not predetermined. It can be shaped and influenced if we seek to act. So how then should education respond to the uncertainty of the future? Well, it means that education cannot be about preparing young people for a predictable, stable world. Instead, education's role in this uncertain world is to do two things. First, to prevent the closure of the future, by which I mean limiting it to one particular vision. The biggest risk we face as a species and as a planet is the loss of abundance, is over-specialization into one form of life, and the erosion of diversity. An urgent and important role for education, therefore, is to protect the diverse ways of knowing and being that there are in the world, because we do not know which of these will be important to our future survival. As we have already heard from both sets of speakers this evening, we need schools that value, nurture, and protect the differences that our students bring with them, and in turn support them to value, nurture, and protect difference themselves. The second job of education is to act as a midwife to bring new and better futures into the world that we cannot anticipate today. Schools have the potential to be the most astonishing places for inventing, creating, and reimagining futures. And indeed, this is what we've heard this evening from the students. They want to learn to live with and learn from their differences. They want to engage actively as makers and actors in the world. So, how can schools become laboratories for the future? Put simply, schools need to become places where students and teachers can do three things. The first of these is build the capacity to play with time and change, and I will explain what I mean by this shortly. The second is to use our subjects to face the future, not the past. And the third is to nurture friendship, love, and community. So what I'm going to do now is just talk through these things. So firstly, playing with time and change. If schools are to act as laboratories for the future, students need to be supported, and arguably we ourselves need to be supported, to see time, history, and change as complex, multi-layered, and open, and to see that this complexity is not a cause for panic, but a resource for creativity. What does this mean? Well, I'd just like you to think about how you visualize the relationship between past, present, and future. Again, close your eyes if this helps. What does the future, what does this relationship between past, present, and future look like? What can you see? What images? Okay, you can open your eyes now. So some of you may have seen an arrow that runs from left to right, left to right. That's my left to right. That's your left to right. From past to present. When we conjure up this sort of image, we're working with the idea of time as linear, with the past flowing into the present, into the future. Others may have seen a line that runs from the bottom left of your vision to the top right. And here we're adding something to our concept of linear time, an idea of progress towards a better future. Now, this is a classic post-Enlightenment, westernized vision of time and change, and it's one that education is deeply tied up with. But there are real problems with this particular conception of progress when we try to think creatively about our relationship with the future. First, this image of time and change as linear and ever moving forward risks complacency. We assume that the rights and achievements that we have secured don't need defending, that the peace we have achieved does not require constant nurture and care. It doesn't allow us to imagine that reversals are possible. Second, it immobilizes us when reversals do happen. We spend our energies working out how to fix the broken arrow, how to get back on the same track, instead of asking whether another route might be desirable. One example of this is our response to the economic crisis of 2007-08. Since this time, we have spent our energies working out how to get back on track, rather than asking whether a different route might be possible and desirable. If we're going to create schools for the future, we need a more complex, rich, and resourceful set of images to support students' ideas of how change happens. And for this, we can look to other cultural traditions for thinking about time and change. Some of you, when you had your eyes shut, may have visualized time in a completely different way. Perhaps you saw time as a series of waves, as civilizations grow and collapse, as societies or populations rise and fall. The great 14th century Islamic sociologist Ibn Khaldun presented societies in this way. Others of you may have imagined cycles, the cycles of the year, of harvest, of new moons, of birth and death, of growth and decay. This is a familiar pattern from indigenous and agricultural traditions, as well as from many Eastern religions. Others of you may have imagined a crystal, a constantly emerging, growing form that will simply grow into different shapes as time moves on. The tree is a powerful symbol of time, knowledge, and growth in many traditions of thought. So seen from this richer perspective, what might be seen as a moment of crisis within a linear narrative of progress instead becomes a moment for the imagination to get to work. It is change, not disaster. It's part of a cycle, not a radical reversal. It is a moment of choice and decision where new branches and future possibilities might emerge. Today, our children in Europe and increasingly around the world are being told that the intergenerational contract is broken, that the old story of progress and gradual improvement in working conditions and expectations can't be sustained, and that they cannot hope for better than their parents. In this context, they and we need a new way of thinking about this moment of change, not as a moment of loss, but a moment for asking profound questions about whether radically different futures might be imagined and brought into being. We need to support our students to question whether there really is only one path towards a better future. And if they want to bring them into being, our children also need to know that change doesn't happen in one direction all the time. It is multi-layered, it is characterized by contradictory and competing forces that are not pulling in the same direction. Just as there is Donald Trump as president, so there are also counter movements at all different levels of society. We can show our children that change is made in many different ways through many different processes, from leadership to education to non-violence and violence, to social movements, law, discoveries, and cultural creation. We have, in other words, to liberate our students and young people from the old story of a linear narrative of process and free them up to see time and change as complex, multi-layered, characterized by reversals and unintended consequences, and always opening up possibilities that are unexpected and creative. That's the theoretical bit. The second thing that we have to do, and this is much more practical, is to think creatively about the curriculum. And I have been to so many conferences on thinking about the future of education. And when we talk about thinking about curriculum redesign for schools, we often get focused on the idea that we need to teach lots of new things, usually 21st century skills. I want to suggest something altogether simpler. What we need to do is to flip the subjects we already teach from their past to their future orientation. So what do I mean? Well, what I mean is we need to stop thinking of subjects as bodies of knowledge and recognize that their very power is their capacity to help us deal with new information and work on the future in different ways. After all, disciplines were invented specifically to tackle an information crisis equivalent to the one we're facing today. They did not always exist. As Chad Wellman has shown in his brilliant book, Organizing Enlightenment, the disciplines or subjects were more or less invented here in Germany, in fact, by the Humboldt brothers, if you can say anybody does this, in the 18th century. And they were invented to deal with the huge proliferation that emerged after the democratization of printing and publishing. Before this time, being educated broadly meant that you'd read all the great books that had gone before and you wrote to all the other educated people about them. In the 18th century, though, there was an information revolution. Suddenly, everyone was reading and publishing, and new ideas and information were circulating ever more quickly. In this context, the old idea of education didn't work anymore. Instead, being educated meant that you need ways of dealing with new information, of working out how to make sense of it, and to connect it up with what had gone before. That meant you needed to specialize and realize that different bodies of knowledge, disciplines, required different ways of judging and making sense of new information. And so, we can understand a discipline or a subject in school less as a body of knowledge and more as a set of procedures for working out how we should deal with new information and change. In and of themselves, therefore, subjects are potentially future-facing. So what this means is that when we teach our subjects, we can flip them to face the future by ensuring that students are not seen merely as recipients of old knowledge, but as active co-producers and analysts of new information. We can see our students as writers, as scientists, as mathematicians, as historians, who are making the world as they learn. For the purpose of our conversation this evening, though, it's worth also noticing that our existing student subjects also do something else. Between them, they have the potential to teach four distinct ways of thinking about and creating the future. And these are often hidden within the subject, but I want to pull them out so that we can understand the work that they have the potential to do. First, our subjects have the potential to teach students to do the most powerful thing they can in thinking about the future. They can support students to create models of the future. This includes the development of mathematical models of the world in maths or simulations in science, but it's also the imagination of alternative worlds and ways of being in literature and theatre. Modelling is powerful because it supports students to play with variables, to examine and engender unintended consequences from their interactions, to explore how different scenarios might come into being, to imagine what it might be like to inhabit a different world. Second, our subjects teach students to steward, to look after information, knowledge, and life forms. Many of our subjects are concerned with supporting children to work out how to care for and preserve diversity into the future. They are encouraged to encounter and keep alive the huge range of ideas, language, ways of knowing and being that characterize the richness of human and material existence. Third, subjects teach reflexivity. They teach students to ask questions about the future that they are being sold. Linguistics, social science, statistics, and philosophy enable students to develop the capacity to analyze, unpick, and challenge narratives of the future. And finally, our subjects teach students to experiment. When done well, they teach students how to invent and reshape their world. This might range from the design of prototypes to the development of social innovations. This includes everything from design and engineering to computing and social sciences. So just as the Humboldt brothers realized that we needed to organize teaching and knowledge differently to deal with the information explosion of the Enlightenment, so we need to reorganize education today so that we can be clearer and more reflexive about the futures-making skills that education can teach. In particular, we need to recognize that being educated today involves the capacity to expertly and fluently move between using these four different skills, between stewardship, reflexivity, modeling, and experimentation. These might become our new faculties, replacing art, science, and humanities. And we might expect our students to work well within all of them. By doing this, we overcome the problem that we've inherited from the Enlightenment, over-specialization. And instead enable the development of rounded students who are able to act ethically, creatively, and rigorously on the world. No more engineers who do not know how to preserve and cherish diversity. No more social scientists who only know how to critique and not to make. And I speak as a social scientist. So the third thing and final element of an education for open futures is arguably, I would say, the most important, namely the ability to understand, recognize, and work with the emotions that thinking about the future necessarily brings. So for one last time, I want you to take a minute and close your eyes and think about how you feel about different ideas of the future. For example, what are your feelings about a business-as-usual future, if everything carries on pretty much as it does today? Or a future of crisis, of catastrophe, when everything descends into chaos? How do you feel about a future where we try to keep going, we just tighten our belts, limit ourselves, and try to fit within constraints? Or what about a future of radical transformation, where we make our way through to a significantly better way of organizing ourselves and our relations with the planet? These four stories of the future are what Jim Dator calls the four core myths of the future: continuity, collapse, restraint, and transformation. And we all tend to be drawn towards one or other. What I'm interested in, though, is how you're feeling in response to these different possibilities. Are you feeling anxiety or hope? Is there desire or passion or deep-seated fear? And what does your emotion do to the way you think you make decisions in the present? If you haven't opened your eyes, do now. So often, we're driven by the desire to avoid futures that we may fear. But we need to note two things. The futures we may fear may bring beauty and possibilities we could never imagine. And here I'm reminded of the brilliant work by Sue Porter at my home university in Bristol that brought together environmental activists and disability campaigners to explore what it means to live with the loss of a future that had been hoped for. Together, they explored the unexpected futures and the new directions that come from moments of disaster and sorrow. Second, we need to notice that hope and clinging to a future that we always thought we wanted can lead us into trouble. It can impede the chance for a new future to emerge. And here, I'm reminded of Vanessa Andreotti's work. She argues that if we are to find a new civilization, we need to give up on the hope for the old futures we grew up with and that we thought we wanted and loved. She argues that it's only by grieving for an old civilization to which we're still emotionally wedded and hospicing it through its final days to death that we can begin to create the possibility for different and better futures to emerge. The critical issue, therefore, is to be attentive to the work that our emotions do when we think about the future, to explore when our emotions are blinding us to possibilities in any situation. And we need to think about what builds our capacity to deal with the fears and desires that thinking about the future brings. How do we do this? If we think of our own lives, the response many of us would make is that friendship, family, and community are the ways in which we get through difficult times and navigate a changing landscape. These relationships, based on love and care, can provide support and solace during difficult times. What would schools look like if they understood that their primary responsibility was to develop students' capacity to love, to be loved, and to build lasting friendships? What would schools look like if their role was not to rescue children from communities, but to support students to build the communities that will sustain them through uncertain times? So to conclude, we need to recognise that there is no single and simple tomorrow that we are preparing young people for. There are many possibilities, all latent in today. And so we need an education that is committed to resisting the closing down of the future to a simplistic vision, whether of technological transformation, cutthroat economic competition, or environmental crisis. We need schools that are laboratories in which young people and teachers work together to explore and create new possibilities in the present. So for those of us working in education, this means, as I've said, we need to draw out of our existing curriculum the way it supports students to act in and on the future by developing the skills of reflexivity, stewardship, modelling and experimentation. It means giving students real opportunities to think about, practice and experiment with how change happens. And finally, it means creating schools that can help young people deal with the emotions of working with the future. This means building young people's capacities to love, build friendship and community. But I need to make one last point, and it's a point that Sharon made earlier, which is we need to recognise that education cannot transform a society on its own. Education is part of a much more complex system that is made up of social actors and forces that are pushing in different directions. Educators cannot promise to solve the world's problems in isolation. Alliances and partnerships are needed between educators and the wider society to address the forces that are closing down the open future. So what does this mean for those of you who are working outside education? It means we need to recognise that education is a collective social responsibility that cannot simply be left to schools. It means we have to support those teachers who are attempting to experiment with new approaches. Creating schools as future-making laboratories will not be easy and will not happen overnight. And finally, it means that we have to work together to create a better political climate for education. We need to challenge the current direction of international OECD-led education policy. We need to point out that it is a crazy, individualised, information-obsessed, linear, measurement-fixated system. We need to argue that it is getting in the way of education's capacity to support students to deal with the intellectual, emotional, and practical challenges of a complex and rapidly changing world. Above all, though, we need as educators and citizens to fight for education to be a space of the unexpected, of surprise, in which the unique contribution of each individual is understood as the beginnings of a new future that we cannot possibly imagine. Valuing that diversity, understanding the strength in an abundance of different ways of being the world, is the only rational response to a world of unknowable and uncertain futures. Crucially, we have to remember we have survived major change before. The 19th century saw electric light, phonographs, wireless, cinema, mass production. And the educational response was rich. We invented playgrounds, new school spaces, universal primary education, widening access to higher education, and laws banning child labour. We had a rich educational imagination, and we need one now that is fueled by the old phrase, pessimism of the intellect and optimism of the will. Thank you for listening.
Thank you so much for your brilliant talk. I'm going to switch into English. I hope you can have patience with my kind of German-Spanish bizarre accent that comes back. I think you have responded to a lot of issues that have been raised by Sharon, as well as by issues raised by the Jugendhakt and Neue Expertinnen. I would like to open the floor in case you want to make a question. We really have to ask you to take a mic because this conversation is going to be simultaneously translated. So I'm hoping to see some raising hands. Yes, please, over there.
Hi, thank you. My question is about cats on printers. I work with a team of educational change makers in Barcelona, and we're opening one of the laboratories for learning that you were mentioning about new approaches to learning and the integration of new technologies. And so my question for you is, what do you want to experiment with? What in these kind of laboratories, what would be the kind of things that you would want to see change makers playing with, experimenting, working with kids to create one of these new learning futures?
That's fabulous. It's a great question. I would like young people to experiment in all areas in which that matter in the world. So I don't think we should focus it just on technology, but I think the capacity to code and to use technology as a creative space rather than, if you like, a dogmatic space is absolutely essential, because the ability to work with data, to understand algorithms as a creative practice will be essential. But I'm interested in that being applied to real issues and questions in the world. So I suppose I wouldn't say young people should do this. I'd say if they can learn to listen to what's happening in the world. So one of the risks that we make when we make schools creative experimental places is that we simply send young people out and we get them to say, right, decide what you think the problems are, go and fix them. This is a bad idea. What we want is for them to go out, to listen, to hear, to think about what people are saying to them, and then to figure out how they can pull all of the resources of school to support that. That might be technological resources, it might be social, it might be creative and imaginative, it might be scientific. So the point is, create a dialogue between school and community that involves listening and responding. This talk tends to have the effect of kind of silence afterwards, in a sort of, oh my God, what am I gonna, how do I think about the future, which is why I talk about the emotional side of it quite a lot, because one of the critical questions is, one of the things I'd do is think about paying attention to the emotions that you have right now. What do they mean? Is it disempowering? Where are the spaces in which you might act? And one of the things that I often do when I work with people around this is to think about what timescale you want to operate on. Because sometimes things can seem deeply traumatic if you operate at too small a timescale. If you open up the length of time, you think, okay, so if I'm thinking about something over the next 100 years, I might have capacity. One of the stories that I was told recently was about the Chinese negotiating with the British over Hong Kong. And who gets to own Hong Kong? And the person said to me, the Chinese were always going to win that one because they said, we have to have China. It doesn't matter how long it takes. And I think that's actually quite useful at the present moment, is to think about if you're planning something or trying to work for the long term, what would you do? So not just acting tactically, but how would you act if you were thinking about doing this over the next couple of hundred years? It can open up some different space for thinking.
Thank you so much for that very enlightening talk. And I was wondering if you might be able to touch upon the question of creating access to different students, teachers, people, in sort of a general sense, also relating to this time continuum that you mentioned.
What do you mean by creating access?
Or just, I think the future of education also holds a lot of questions relating to access. Who has access to education? Yeah. Who is allowed to go to certain school? Who is stuck in certain, in the German education system. For example, you have like Realschule and Gymnasium, and these school structures are also quite inhibiting in a way. And I was wondering if you could relate this question to your time continuum. Thank you.
I mean, we currently have a new prime minister in the UK who is going the clinically insane route of trying to bring back grammar schools in the UK. It's a lovely time. This is why I have to think long term, because if I think short term, it's too depressing. I think that there are fundamental questions that we have to ask about schooling as a whole. So one of my slight concerns is the international move towards thinking that schooling is the answer to every problem. Education is. Schools might not be. Or schools might be, but they might need to take different forms. So I think we need to fight some of the fights around access in the present, but not also get hung up on the idea, if you like, that the gymnasium or the grammar school is the height of the education that we want. So we need to be thinking at two different levels at the same time. One is the longer term question, which is what is the nature of educational institutions that can support the sorts of creative learning that we need, the social learning. Now, these may be very different. They might be smaller institutions that have much greater interconnection between society, universities, and schools themselves. So they might not look anything like the ones that we're trying to get young people into at the moment. At the same time, as Sharon has pointed out, the schools, the systems and structures that exist at the moment are reproducing inequalities. So we have to fight both of those battles at the same time, but not get fixated on the idea that if only we can get all the children of the world into school, or if only we can get all children to have a gymnasium education, that everything will be fine. So it's sort of running those two things in parallel with each other, I think.
Okay. So thank you for your talk. I really enjoyed it. I never had the feeling like she's telling bullshit, I have to go, so that was good. Thank you for the students who presented their wishes. And I have the feeling that we have a gap in Germany and probably all over the world that school doesn't trust the children. And we grow in a world with ever more potential. And so they want responsibility, they want to do, they want to show, they want to make mistakes. And neither in society nor at school they have this chance. So my thinking is, why not handing over the managing of the schools to the children? Start really meaning it, democracy as it is, saying this is your place. You are responsible for the finance, for hiring and firing teachers and everything in the community. And this is what, by the way, if you are close to Bristol and Ashburton, there's the Sand School.
I do know them, yeah.
And so you can relax there.
I think one of the students here would quite like to say something in response to that. There's a student behind,
Anne Hakavi is director as well. There's a good combination.
So, in my opinion, this wouldn't work. Just because of the simple fact that all the people wouldn't hear on kids, because if we have an idea and we're proposing it, they will not accept it, because they will say, yeah, they're just kids, they don't have an idea of life. Yes, right, thanks. And if you're working with a kid, okay, and you both have the knowledge of an topic, but the kid has maybe, I don't know, like a few more ideas about this topic and have a bit more knowledge about that, and he's saying that to you, you will just be like, what are you talking about? You're a kid, you have no idea about life, so shut up and we will do it like I say. It's the same thing with our parents. Yeah, so it wouldn't work, and if we will try it, it will be the case. Because, to be honest, we are all like between 13 and 16, and it wouldn't work.
Thank you.
Could you?
Yeah, I just want to continue on these two remarks and related to one of, for me, the crucial sentences of your talk, when you said, "Let the students make the world as they learn." This, I mean, is a revolutionary sentence related to schools. And my first question would be, would that mean, because if students in learning are supposed to transform the world, society have also to give them the means to do that. So schools would have to connect with companies, with politicians, with, let's say, all actors in society, to be able to transform the learning process in a doing process. This is my first question. Second question is, this sounds great, but is there not also a big problem behind that? Because, which was also involved in what you said, is should schools not be also a space where you can try out something without taking the responsibility to implement it? Or the other way around, are we not already in a society where all thinking, all imagination directly get transformed into practice and is not really reflected on? So I think to put children, students, and to some extent even adults permanently in the situation that their learning processes becomes applied in technologies and so on is also a big danger.
Okay, there's a huge amount there. I'm glad we're on these topics because these are really important. So good, we've got to the meat of the issue. I really want to pick up on that last point first. I am not suggesting that schools become only places of practical action where what you learn has to be applied tomorrow. That is a misunderstanding, and I have not articulated myself clearly. Experiment means exploration, means creation, means imagination. Also, stewardship means holding, caring, protecting. Schools as places where children can act in and out of the world. The critical thing is can, not must. There is choice involved in this. The key way in which I see a school is a separate time from the rest of society, okay? So, but it is a time, if we imagine the relationship, I'm never sure if this metaphor works, by the way, I'm just gonna try it again. So if you imagine the relationship between a river and the sea, or between a riverbank and the river, there's a concept in biology called the ecotone. And the ecotone is a space in between. So if we think about schools, we can think about them as spaces in between. So in the ecotone, new things get generated. Some of them go on and play a role in the world. Some of them grow and fall off. The point is that they are generative spaces, not spaces where children simply accept the knowledge that has gone before that is handed into them. That's critically the difference. So no, it is not about compelling both students and teachers to become constantly productive. In that direction, we head to neoliberal economics, which is mad. The point is a generative space where imagination and possibility can flourish. The second issue around students and governance and leadership, it strikes me there's a number of different levels. Student leadership. So you can involve young people, and it happens all over the world, that young people are involved in things like selecting teachers, governing schools, and playing a role in partnership. I actually don't believe in getting rid of adults and children running schools. I think that misses one of the big issues that we are likely to be facing over the next 50 years, which is intergenerational conflict. And I think what we actually need to do is to work out how we build collaboration between adults and children. So there are different sorts of expertise that young people bring into a school and different sorts of expertise that adults bring. The challenge is, what are the mechanisms that allow them to connect with each other? And my favorite phrase, it's an Alfred Whitehead phrase, a philosopher of education, and he talks about schooling as being where the adventure of thought meets the adventure of action. And he also talks about schooling as a place where you create living knowledge. So it is about bringing what we already know, but putting it into encounter with the new realities and the new situations that young people are living in. So my point, and again, because I spent a lot of time working in technology and because I spent a lot of time talking about 21st century education, I hear often the idea that we should get rid of the teacher, if you like, and have the young people. And I think what that does is it ignores and it hides what it is that teachers do when they are working well. And the risk of saying that is that we put all the responsibility onto the child. And as we know, not all children have the same resources or the same capacity to make the most of different situations. So there is a huge risk in the discourse of flipping responsibility into education to children, in that it responsibilizes them, it makes them responsible wholly, and it can, if you're not careful, lead to increasing inequalities. So my point is really, can we build dialogue between adults and children? Can we build mutual respect? Can we build collaboration? That way we get truly democratic schools, because democracy is about different generations negotiating with each other, which if we don't do over the next 50 years, we're really, really in trouble.
Again.
I think it's my turn. Yeah, I would like to bring back the discussion to maybe a more practical point of view, because I'm working for a project which is supposed to connect teachers with new media experts, with the idea to introduce more new media into schools. And we were trying very hard, and then it turned out teachers don't really want to do that, you know. So it was really surprising to me, because I thought, you know, we're bringing all this in, these great people who have a lot of positive, could have a lot of positive effects on the students, and there was kind of like a wall of resistance we hit, and it really surprised me, because I thought those are people that are expecting people to learn every day, and then when they get asked to learn something, they're quite reluctant to do so. So I was just wondering, from a very practical point of view, like, what is your approach to making teachers learn more, maybe?
Okay. I mean, teachers are human, you know. So, yeah, some of them are going to be more up for trying things and others aren't. I think we need to understand the conditions that they are operating within. And for many of them, they are operating within very hostile, controlling regimes where they are being judged against a certain very limited number of outputs. And in that context, there is absolutely no incentive to keep trying to do something different. This is why I was making the point about OECD and league tables and the way in which we assess schools. So the critical thing I would say is, if you're an expert in social media, what can you do to create a social media revolution disrupting this appalling framing of how we think about what education is? So if you want to create the conditions within which teachers can operate as professionals, in other words, as people who are constantly reflecting on their own learning, it would be really helpful if you could draw on those skills to change the conditions that teachers are operating within.
I have a question here. I would like to get, yes, please, Malik.
So I have a question. If we can't change our school itself, how can we change the school, like, generally? Because we're sitting here and talking about how change school, and there are like a lot of schools we can't change in, with our problems and not the problems of all of the other one. Like, before we before we prepare to face the problems of our school, we are facing the problems of the other school. And how can we change our school first?
Your school first?
Yes.
Yeah, that's a tricky one. I mean, I think critically, think about the different ways in which change has happened historically. So how does it happen? It happens by mobilizing groups of people. It happens by producing evidence. So some of the things you guys were talking about, there is research out there that can help you make your case. So use that research, particularly the late starts and the homework. There's a lot, okay? So I'm just telling you now, Google it, you'll find the research. So research, social movements. Who are the allies? Who else might have the same views and opinions as you? What are the leverage points? What are the critical things that are shaping? What's causing things to stay the same? So you remember that slide I put up that's got all the different layers? You might decide to go the legal route. Are there any implications for your human rights of the way in which your schooling is currently worked? In the US, basically, huge changes have happened by trying to change the law. So think about, there are lots of different sorts of ways. I can't tell you because I don't know your situation. But what I can say is there are many, many different ways in which change happens. The critical issue is actually really boring. It's about persistence, which we forget. Persistence, stubbornness. If you want to change something, pick what it is and then know you maybe are going to have to work on it for quite a while. So maybe pick one of those topics and work on it persistently and consistently. Because one of the issues that we're living in is we're living in a social media world where we think that if we press the button, we can make change happen really quickly. Actually, it's slow, it's long. And the thing that we need to remember is change has happened before. The world is very different now in education than it was only 100 years ago. So change does happen, but it happens by the very long, slow process of campaigning and lobbying and researching and making the case and experimenting. And that's what it will take. But if you operate, if that's what you want, you can actually achieve it.
I would like to add that we would very much like to invite all of you, the new experts, the Jugendtakt people, to continue working with us, with the same stubbornness on the competition of ideas, on trying to develop what's on your agenda, on trying to get research, and that's an invitation for the year to come. We would love to work with you. We are going to take two more questions. I have one there and one there. Yeah. Maybe we start, and then we collected two questions. Oh, is it related? Sorry. We need the mic. Malek, do you still have the mic? No.
I have it here. I have it here.
Oh, Maria. Okay, then we go back to you and then, yeah.
Okay. So shall I ask the question? Yeah?
Yeah.
Okay. So
I won't forget you. Just a second, it's because of the mic. Yeah. Okay. Maria.
Yeah, thank you very much. Well, my name is Maria Caso, and I'm working in education revolution all over the world, especially in Spain and Latin America. And in all of the congress that I go, there is always these two big issues about technology and curriculum and content. But I'm really, really worried about methodologies. And I'm really worried about methodologies because in a lot of these events, we're talking about changing methodologies with an old methodology of Congress, like what is happening now here, which is a very vertical way of transmitting knowledge and with a very old, it's like a church, really, what is happening here. So I really appreciate, of course, the efforts. Tomorrow is going to be a lot of work and everything, but I really think that we have a very, very deep problem in methodologies, and I want to know what you think about that. And I also think that art is a kind of methodology that will save us. So maybe you have also something to talk up about art as a methodology for changing methodologies. Thank you.
Good. Could you please pass the mic to the representative of Jugendtakt? Thank you.
Please. Yes, you. I thought she asked.
Geht auf Deutsch. Ja, wir warten mit der Frage.
Okay. So I kind of got what you said, but I see a huge problem in the power the school has about the students. So if, which marks we get in school, for example, and how we do in school actually kind of defines our future life. In the end, it just depends on the number on a final sheet. And I think it's hard to try to change that something maybe with rebellion if this school could possibly just say, oh, well, we're sick of you. We can just throw you off the school and, yeah, well, you see what you got. Because there's actually something to which happened to a friend of me. And I think more students will actually try to accomplish change, but they have fear, actually. And how can we cope with that?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Right, two good, really big, hard questions. On methodology and art practice, I entirely agree with you. I think we need to find new ways that we work together as communities. I think what's interesting about this conference is it hasn't done what often happens, which is you just have somebody come along and speak, and then everybody kind of goes away. What we've got, hopefully, is space over the next 2 days to do some work together, which is really, really important. I think there are, my experience is that there are new technologies like open space approaches, that the approaches from the Transition Town movement in the UK are getting much better at allowing bottom-up agenda setting amongst large groups, which I think is actually critically important. So we need to appropriate some of that. And I'd agree on the arts practice, but not alone. I'd agree on the arts practice because if we don't have imagination, we have absolutely nothing. So we absolutely need that, but we also need it alongside the critical social science that works out the facts and the data and what's going on, and the modeling and the creative digital production. You know, there is not one method that will save us in all of this. We need many to work alongside each other. I think the other thing that worries me about the international landscape of discussions about the future of education is that there is a shift towards having gurus that stand on stage and make a lot of money out of giving big talks and promising the future. And I think what we need to do is in this room recognize that the expertise is in all of us and it is our collective encounter and that it does not rely on one person standing at the front giving TED Talks. So that's a slight obsession of mine. Anyway, now to your question. This is really, really hard. Schooling, it is at present a system of control, and it is a system of domination through precisely exams and assessment. And I'm not going to pretend that that is not a fundamental problem. I mean, so if it were left to me, we'd be removing all forms of assessment right now. I think I suppose one of the things that we tend to do, though, is we think that if we get the grades, we'll be safe. Okay? So if we get those grades, and then we get into university, and we get into a particular job, that everything will be okay. Actually, the grades are a tiny part of what builds you surviving and thriving in life. So many other things matter. And actually, as I've said, a lot of the jobs and the work is going to be changing. So there are interesting questions about whether doing the right thing in school at the moment is going to be the best way for you thriving and surviving in the future. So what I would say is they are powerful institutions, schools, and it is incredibly difficult to challenge within them when you feel that. But just remember that your future survival is not dependent on your grades. It's dependent on you having confidence. It's depending on you having imagination. It's depending on you learning stuff. It's depending on you having friends. Those things will actually determine whether you survive and thrive, not the actual grade. And I understand that's really, 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 really hard to believe when you're operating in the education system that you're operating at the moment. But it is actually true.
We have a very last question, please.
Okay, it's not a question, it's more a comment on the woman who talked before about the teachers who don't want to learn. I'm a teacher, I want to learn, that's the reason why I'm here. So I have to say that it is important to think about the circumstances we work in. We have less time. We have a lot of bureaucratic bureaucracy to deal with. I just remember the Abitur started, the Math Abitur was written in Hamburg yesterday, and now we have to correct those words and fill in lots of formulas to say which pupil did how many points on which task and things like this. And it's eating time. And we work on schools which part of, in Hamburg we have those Gesamtschule, Stadtteilschule, and it's like we have all kind of children at school. I think it's a wonderful idea. But we also have all those children who are living in so dangerous circumstances that they get dangerous. And it's a very emotional work to deal with. And sometimes I come home and I see my son and think how God thanks he's laughing. So if I don't close my soul, it's emotional hard work. And if I close my soul, I go against the idea of a community and a laboratory of love and friendship and everything else, so I can't close. And under those circumstances, all those teachers live, and some of them live them there for 20, 30, 40 years. And I don't think it's normal to say, I don't have time to learn anymore. I have to survive. And I think it's important for all of those who are not teachers, for all of those who are outside of school, as Carrie Fraser said, please help us to change community, to change our working place to a place where we can learn. Because it's not so that you go to school and say, please teach us learn, and the teachers say, oh no, da habe ich keinen Bock zu. They say, oh yes, would be great, but I don't have time for it, I don't have energy for it. So please help us.
So I think it's really important to finish on that point. I mean, I see a lot of teachers going through burnout because they're trying really hard and they're hitting a lot of walls. And that is why I made my last point. So education is a social practice. It is not something that teachers on their own do to children. And we need to build the alliances between teachers and a whole load of other people. So one of the things that I tend to do is when I work with my colleagues at universities and they don't think that schools are important, I point out to them that the schools are generating the students they have to work with. So the critical issue is to form alliances. Who else is on your side? Who else cares about education? And that's why this conference, I think, is really exciting, because it really is about the potential across the whole of Germany to build alliances and networks so that we recognize education as the responsibility not just of the teacher on their own, trying and struggling to keep their hearts open at the time where they're also marking 500 exam scripts. We need to build those relationships across the whole country. And I think if this conference can do that, and if these projects can do that, then that will be wonderful, because it means that the rest of us in the other countries can go, look, if Germany can do that, we can do it. So I'm gunning for you all. Please do it. Thank you.
I would like to add some final remarks on this evening. I'm very thankful for your words.